Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to today's Rural Health Clinics Technical Assistance Transitioning to ICD-10 What You Need to Know conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. For opening remarks and introductions, I'd like to turn the conference over to Bill Finnerbrock. Mr. Finnerbrock, please go ahead.
Thank you, operator, and I want to welcome everyone to today's teleconference. I am Bill Finnerbrock, and I'm the Executive Director of the National Association of Rural Health Clinics, and I'll be the moderator for today's call. Our presenter today is Denise Benning. Denise is a senior advisor with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services Office of eHealth Standards and Services, and she's going to be talking with us today and providing an overview of the ICD-10 standards as well as the software requirements that you'll need to meet in order to handle ICD-10 coding. Denise is a senior advisor and HIPAA team leader at CMS and the Office of eHealth Standards, and she authored both the agency's proposed and final ICD-10 rules. Her areas of responsibility include the ICD-10 Program Management Office, HIPAA Transaction and Code Set Enforcement, and HIPAA Administrative Simplification. The format for today's call consists of about a 45-minute presentation followed by 15 minutes of questions for Denise. This call series, as you know, is sponsored by the Health Resources and Services Administration's Federal Office of Rural Health Policy and is presented in conjunction with the National Association of Rural Health Clinics. The purpose of this series is to provide RHC staff with valuable technical assistance and RHC-specific information. Today's call is the 37th in the series, which began in late 2004, and during that time, over 9,000 individuals have participated in the bi-monthly RHC national teleconferences. As you all know, there is no charge to participate in this series. We encourage you to refer others who might benefit from this to sign up to receive announcements regarding call dates, topics, and speaker presentations. You can get that information or how to sign up by going to www.ruralhealth.hrsa.gov/RHC. During the question and answer period, we ask that you provide your name and your location by state before asking your question. And in the future, if you have questions or topics you'd like to recommend, you can submit those to info@narhc.org, and we will consider all recommendations. At this point, I'd like to turn the control over to Denise, and we look forward to your remarks, Denise.
Good afternoon, Bill. Thank you so much, and thank you to the National Association of Rural Health Clinics for this opportunity to spend some time with you this afternoon talking about my favorite subject, and I'm sure it's yours as well, ICD-10 and version 5010. It's pouring rain here in Baltimore. It's very soggy, so it's a good afternoon just to kind of hunker down and spend some time talking about these two really important initiatives. And in particular, I'm glad to have this opportunity to talk to you because you are an integral part of Rural Health in America, and this is a group that we're really trying to reach out to because we understand that you have some unique needs, some very special needs in terms of communication and in terms of being able to make this transition successfully. So I, again, really thank you for the opportunity and hope to have a good dialogue with you today. On the second slide, we're going to just kind of set the stage for our discussion today and talk about some of the things we're going to talk about. And that's typically what exactly is going to change with version 5010 and ICD-10, why are we making these changes, what predicated our decision. Important dates, there are a number of key dates both from a final compliance perspective and also from an interim deadline perspective that you really need to know and keep up with. And some key details on both ICD-10 and version 10, and most importantly, resources that we have available to you that are going to be able to help you prepare for this transition. On slide number 3, what's changing? There are two things that are changing, and the first one is our medical diagnosis and inpatient procedure code sets. You know them mostly as ICD-9, and that's going to be changing to ICD-10. The second part of what's changing is what we call HIPAA standards for electronic healthcare transactions. Currently 4010, 4010A, and that's going to an upgraded version 5010. Now, I'll be honest with you, when I've talked to providers, especially about version 5010, their eyes kind of glaze over because they don't really know 5010. They're not familiar with the terminology. And we had some focus groups on this. I guess it was back at the end of last year. We were sitting here in a Baltimore facility and kept talking about version 5010. You can just see the providers going, what are you talking about? So I kept sending notes in and said, ask them this question, ask them that question. I finally sent in some questions that said, do they ever do an eligibility inquiry? And, oh, yes, yeah, we check on eligibility, and we get remittance advices. Those they knew. They knew the transactions, but not necessarily the platform that they were operating off of because, again, most of this is embedded in the terms of 5010 in the software that you use, either in practice management or other types of programs that you may be running. So just to set the story straight is, version 5010 may not be all that familiar to the providers out there, but it soon will be. I always use the analogy of a car. I don't necessarily care what's under the hood. All I want to know is that when I turn the key, the car goes the way it should. So it's the same thing with 5010. Most folks don't realize they have it embedded, but it is, and it makes the engine run. On slide number 4. Let's talk a little bit more about the ICD-9 codes that we currently use and why we're changing them. If anybody spent some time reading both the proposed rule and the final rule changing from ICD-9 to ICD-10, this story is probably a little familiar to you. ICD-9 was developed back, 35 years ago, and it's really outdated. It doesn't account for new technologies like laser surgery. It doesn't give you differentiation between the left side of the body and the right side of the body. You end up having to do multiple codes to arrive at a single diagnosis or a single procedure. It also gives us very limited data about medical conditions and inpatient procedures that are taking place. From a practical standpoint, we're really out of space. As I think most of you know, these codes go in chapters. There's a cardiology chapter, a neurology chapter, whatever. And it's to the point now where the Coordination and Maintenance Committee, which oversees updates to the code set standards, is having to jerry-rig this thing. It's really a Band-Aid approach. They're sticking I codes in cardiology and vice versa just to have a place to put them. And imagine being a coder trying to find a code that you're looking for and, having to just to know that, that I code is actually in the cardiology chapter. So it doesn't make for good healthcare administration. It doesn't make for improved workflows. It kind of bogs things down. So given all of that and given the fact that all of the other countries in the civilized world, as I call it, are already transitioned to ICD-10, it just makes a lot of sense. I remember when the H1N1 pandemic kind of broke out last year, and I remember thinking, boy, if we had ICD-10 in place, we'd be able to really compare our data across different countries. And at this point in time, we're not yet able to do that, but the ICD-10 is going to rectify that. On our next slide, slide number 5, who is subject to all of this change? And basically, it's anybody covered by HIPAA, and of course you all know HIPAA, the Health Insurance Portability and Affordability Act, Accountability Act, excuse me, of 1996. Anybody who functions as a health provider, payer, clearinghouse, third-party billing service, anybody who comes under HIPAA, and not just those providers who file under Medicare or Medicaid claims, have to switch over to ICD-10 because it is a HIPAA standard. And this really runs the gamut. It goes from large national health plans, regional health plans, small provider offices, laboratories, health clinics, hospitals. There are very few entities at this point that aren't HIPAA covered. There are a couple, though, that was included in the regulation, and two that stand out are workers' compensation programs and life insurance companies. Those entities currently are not covered under HIPAA. But when you take a look at the entire healthcare industry and the spectrum of healthcare services, even those non-covered entities that aren't technically mandated to change over, you know, really need to take a look to see whether they should change over, because anything that's submitted with an older code as of October 1st of 2013 is probably going to be put to the back of the pile when it comes to payment, and it's going to take longer to handle those claims. So I think it's going forward, as we see what the trend is in terms of administrative simplification and achieving efficiencies in reducing administrative costs, anything that we can do to help that along in the process, I think is really where we're trending to. Okay, on slide number 6, we talk about important dates to know. One of the things that we always talk about is two primary dates. The first one is January 1st of 2012, and that is when all HIPAA and covered entities must be compliant with version 5010. So that means if you're submitting electronic claims as of that date, you're going to have to use the version 5010 transaction standards. October 1st of 2013 is when ICD-10 comes into play. And the reason that version 5010 comes before ICD-10 is because version 5010 accommodates the ICD-10 codes, whereas the current version 4010 does not. So you have to have 5010 in place first. It has to be tested in order to, again, a year and a half later or so, implement ICD-10. There's an interim deadline there that's really important, and that is actually coming up here rather quickly. January 1st of 2011 is when providers and payers, anybody who works with electronic claims, should be testing with their partners, testing externally outside of their own organizations to make sure that the transactions are going through and that they're getting the correct responses. 2010 has really been an internal testing year for version 5010. Everybody has been, you know, again, making their software changes, loading them into the systems, and testing internally to see that it works properly. The end of this year and then the beginning of all next year is pretty much a testing phase externally. And, in fact, Medicare fee-for-service is going to be ready to test externally beginning in January. So that will be a significant milestone for them. So the other important thing you need to know about these dates is that they're firm. We don't use the C word, contingency. We have been given absolutely no reason to believe that this is going to be delayed, because a lot of ICD-10 and 5010 is foundational for other things like electronic health records, meaningful use, and all the other programs that are coming down our way in the next couple of years. So the administration did have an opportunity when it first came on board to review this regulation and to look at the dates, and they've given us the go-ahead to proceed with it. So that's the platform that we're working towards. I can tell you that CMS implementation internally is progressing at a good clip. You know, as a covered entity ourselves, our Medicare and our Medicaid programs have to be HIPAA compliant as well. And given that, we have a dual responsibility not only to get our own house in order and make sure that we're ready to process claims, but also our contractors, our state Medicaid programs, and we have to help the rest of the industry as well. So we wear many hats here, and it's been a terrific experience for us to work with the industry and work with providers and payers and clearinghouses to really take this forward and to make it work. On slide number 7, we talked a little bit about preparation. As I said, the compliance deadlines are mandatory, and I think there may be some confusion out there among providers. I remember we did some groups, some focus groups with providers, and they told us, oh, well, we're just going to continue to use the 9 codes. It'll be okay. And we said, no, it's not an either-or. You have to change over to the 10 codes, because if you continue to use the 9 codes, you're not going to get your claims paid. And some of them were surprised to hear that. So it's not a choice. It is a mandate. And ICD-9 codes, this is a little bit different. You know, every year the Coordination and Maintenance Committee upgrades the codes. So there are some changes. It's kind of like, you get a manual, and every year or so there are a couple of pages that change out, and you take out the old pages and put in the new. And you know, that's what we pretty much have gone on. ICD-10 is a completely different story because there's structural differences in ICD-10. And it's not just a matter of expanding a field to accommodate another digit or an alphanumeric system. It really is a very vast departure from what we've used before. And we've also gotten the question in our regulatory comment process. Many people said, well, why don't you just not even go to ICD-10, just wait till ICD-11? Well, number one, that's a number of years off, and it hasn't even really been into development yet for use in the United States. And number two, you can't make that leap from 9 to 11. The platform is just too different, and you really have to go through the intermediate step of 10 in order to even get to 11. So all of the experts, all of the folks that we talked to really advise us not to try and skip 10 and to go to 10. That's obviously we took their advice. If you don't, again, if you're not ready, you're going to face rejected claims and delays in reimbursements. So it's not something that you can just turn the switch on. And that's why I know, here we are in September of 2010, and it seems like these dates are a long way off. Well, they're really not, and it's not the kind of project that you can look at 6 months ahead of time and all of a sudden really take the initiative on. This takes years of planning, and I can tell you I've been on this plan since, I guess the summer of 2007. So it definitely takes thought, it takes planning, it takes a lot of effort to do this, and we hope that by sharing information among ourselves, among our colleagues in industry, that they can learn from what we've done and apply it to their own situations. Okay, on slide number 8, just a little bit more technical information on ICD-10. There are two parts to the code set, and one is the diagnosis codes. That's the ICD-10-CM, clinical modification, and that's used pretty much in all healthcare settings. ICD-10-PCS is used only for inpatient procedure coding in hospital settings. So CPTs that are being used for outpatient procedures are not affected by this transition. They're still in place. On slide number 9, obviously, ICD-10-CM replaces 9 for diagnosis coding. In 9, we had approximately 3 to 5 digits. In ICD-10, we're going from to up to almost 7 digits. And again, a change in the formatting is going to be really significant here. On slide number 10, we talk about the procedure codes. Again, ICD-10-PCS replaces ICD-9-CM, I believe it's volume 3, for procedure codes. We're going from 3 to 4 digits to 7 alphanumeric. Very, very different from the 9 codes, and ICD-10 expands details for many, many conditions. We go from approximately, I believe it's 15,000 total codes to 155,000 codes. Now, that seems like a tremendous leap. And in a way it is, but basically what has happened is that each one of the ICD-10 codes is so specific, and it really reflects, in a sense, almost numerous ICD-9 codes. So you do have crosswalks in between, and we'll explain that in a second. But it provides so much more specific data. It really reflects current medical practices, and it's got room to expand. And the information is going to be so much more robust. I was really amazed to know that under ICD-9, for example, in order to differentiate between a right arm break and a left arm break, you had to go through a number of different iterations, and I just thought that was fascinating because you would think it would be pretty simple. The other thing I want to talk about when we expand the the code sets from 15,000 to 155,000. And I always use the phone book analogy on this. I've heard from providers, oh, my gosh, I can't deal with 155,000 codes. Well, number one, you won't have to because, you know, part of those are procedure codes that are only used in hospital inpatient settings. But also, it's like a phone book. Every number is in there. That doesn't mean you're going to use every number in the book, but there may be some numbers that you frequently use that you would pick out, or if you happen to need a number, it's there. So it's not like you're using every code. You're just using it as a reference. And when you need it, if you have frequently used codes, pull those out and put them on a super bill or put them in your system up front, and the other ones are there for you to use as you need them. So you don't have to deal with a massive amount of codes. Now, there are some exceptions to that. We know that because of the very nature of their practices, family physicians, internists, probably emergency medical personnel, are going to be using more of the codes just because they see a wider variety in their caseload. So we're really trying to reach out to family practitioners, internists, anybody who has a real need to have a vaster knowledge of the codes and get them on board early and often. So again, going on to slide number 12, a little bit of an explanation on version 5010. Again, it refers to the new HIPAA standards for electronic healthcare transactions, and those transactions include functions like claim eligibility inquiries, remittance advices. Again, people are most familiar with the transactions, not necessarily the platform that gets them there. We currently use 4010, and 4010 has been around again a while. It's had some Band-Aids slapped on it. There were some initial problems with it, and the industry came to the X12 Standards Development Organization and asked for some changes, and it's pretty much been in place for quite some time. We are hearing that the transition from 4010 to 5010 is maybe less problematic than the transition to ICD-10, number one. We've had some experience with 4010, so this is kind of an upgrade to the system. However, we've never adopted a new medical code set, and that's a whole new game for us, so we don't have anything to really base an experience on. And, of course, the most important thing about version 5010 is it accommodates the ICD-10 code set. And from what I understand, it's not just a matter of having a larger field, but there actually is an indicator within the 5010 standards themselves that tell you that you're using an ICD-10 code, and that's really key because if the system doesn't recognize the code, then the transaction won't be able to support it. So on slide number 13, talking about implementation timelines. As I said, we started working on this many years ago. Because for an organization as large as CMS and for a program as large as Medicare and Medicaid, we realized that it wasn't, again, going to be just a matter of flipping a switch. So the implementation timeline for 5010 allows for a year of external testing. As I think I said before, CMS is on time. They are going to be starting to accept testing claims for 5010 on January 1st of 2011, and they'll continue to accept version 4010 at the same time, so they'll be kind of dual channeling there. And they're just doing that to make sure that everybody's on board with 5010 before ICD-10 implementation really kicks into gear, probably towards the end of next year, early 2012. So, again, you remember your dates on number 14, January 2011, fee-for-service Medicare starts testing, January 1st of 2012, full implementation of version 5010, and October 1st, 2013, full implementation of ICD-10. And the other thing I'd like to say about the October date especially is that there is no phase-in. There is no differentiation between compliance dates, whether you're a small health plan or a big health plan, as we had with some of the previous HIPAA compliance standards. That doesn't exist here. And the reason for that October 1st date is because that's the beginning of the fiscal year, and that's when all the systems change over here. So people have kind of asked why you just put it to January, and that's the reason why, because it's the beginning of the fiscal year. So on slide number 15, how do you prepare? we took kind of a step-by-step approach to this here at CMS, and the first thing we did was we went all throughout our agency and we queried everybody and said, where do you use ICD-9 codes, with the assumption that if you're using ICD-9 codes in a certain area, you're most likely going to be using ICD-10. And we had an association, the contract, the American Health Informatics Management Association, do that for us. It took a while. Again, we're a very large organization, but you can also do the same thing within smaller organizations as well. Send out a memo. Assign someone to go through and ask people questions about their systems, ask about policy, manuals, forms, etc., and kind of go through each one of your business processes and see where these codes pull up. Talk with your vendors about their plans for version 5010 and ICD-10. When we did focus groups, again, a while back, we had a group of medical office managers in, and we said, well, who are you going to go to for information on this? Who are you going to call? And they all came back and they said, Bob. And we all kind of looked at each other and said, who's Bob? And it's like, oh, Bob's our software guy. And like three out of the four people in the room said, oh, yeah, we all use Bob. He's great. He has our practice management software, and he'll just call us and tell us when he's going to come install this. And we were just kind of shell-shocked because it was like, it just can't possibly be that simple. But we actually did track Bob down, identified him, and asked him to come at a vendor conference, and he took us kind of through the paces of how he dealt with his customers and how he was planning to implement this. So that's probably your first best line of defense, is to talk to whoever is installing or maintaining your practice management software or other software that might contain these codes or performs these transactions. If you're not doing it, talk to your clearinghouses. Talk to your billing services. Discuss your plan. Say, you know, I'm getting ready to change my systems over on X date, or I'm getting ready to test on at this particular point in time. Are you going to do the same thing? Talk with your payers. Talk with the plans about how ICD-10 implementation might affect your contracts. There are some contracts that have this built in. There are some contracts that, from a program management perspective or practice management perspective, offer immediate updates. So it's really important that you start talking to everyone who's involved in your systems and your policies and your processes, and get them all on the same page. You also need to take a look at training on slide number 16. One of the key issues that was identified for us in both our proposed rule and subsequently in our final rule was staff training needs. A lot of people code, but they're not officially coders. A lot of people didn't identify themselves as coders, but they do code. So it could be, you know, an office manager. It could be the provider, him or herself. It could be a nurse. It could be a technician. It could be a business office person. So you really have to find out who is doing the coding for your organization. And it's really important to budget in time and budget in expenses that are going to be required. And what I've often told folks, if you can do a train-the-trainer, if you can send maybe one person out from an organization who can come back and train others, or if you can collaborate, if you have any kind of consortium arrangement, or can share resources, that would be the best way to do it. And we also discussed the fact that the experts in this area, and with that I mean AHIMA and the American Academy of Professional Coders, strongly advise that you don't do training until you're 6 months out of the compliance date. And the reason for that is because it's the old axiom, if you don't use it, you're going to lose it. And if you get training on these codes and then you don't use them, you go back to using ICD-9 codes until it's time to code to 10, you're going to forget it. So we're really strongly urging people to take advantage. And there are so many different training opportunities out there, online, in-person, webinar. It's really, I'm pleasantly surprised at the plethora of different training opportunities that are available out there. You don't necessarily have to attend in person a five-day seminar. But it's really important that you keep that in mind, that you will have some workflow issues with personnel out of the office and getting this training, and, again, trying to keep up to date on resources and information. And speaking of resources, on slide number 17, there are a lot of resources out there to help you prepare. The CMS website is www.cms.gov/ICD-10, no hyphen there. And this really, we've revamped it. And when I say revamped it, we've done it within the confines of our federal web page architecture. So maybe it's not as flashy and as pretty as we'd like it to be. But I think it's very useful because it segments out information for providers, for payers, for Medicare fee-for-service, for vendors. It gives information on the national calls that we have that people can dial into for free and sit and listen to questions and answers on various aspects of 5010 and ICD-10 implementation. And I think also, you know, we have a number of publications. We have fact sheets, and I think you'll see some of those on slide number 18. Just, again, quick pieces that you can reproduce. You can distribute at a medical staff meeting, or, you know, stuff in an envelope or hand out at another professional get-together or whatever. And they really are just, I don't want to say down and dirty, but they're simple, they're quick, and they refer you on to where to get more information. The other thing that we have is a listserv sign-up, and you can actually see a screenshot of this on slide number 19. And what you can do is sign up to be in our ICD-10 listserv, and what it will do is every time there's a change or an update to our website, it will send you out an automatic notice saying something is changed, you might want to take a look at it. We also are pushing out listserv messages on a weekly basis. Just, and I think if you went through the National Provider Identifier campaign, NPI, you saw them come out with messages every other week that said, you know, NPI is coming, are you ready, have you checked this out, are you aware of the compliance dates, et cetera. And we're doing the same thing with ICD-10. And the great thing is that we have expanded this. We've gone from, I think we started this at the end of June, and we've gone from around 583 opt-ins to, I think, the last number I got earlier this week was over 9,000. So we have over 9,000 people who are getting these messages, and we're starting to see the numbers climb. So there's lots of materials there. There are lots of basics, you know, just introduction types of materials that you can share. Talking back to your vendors about ICD-10, what questions you should be asking, basics for medical practices. And we also have links to professional clinical and trade associations, because we realize that we're not the only game in town. We would certainly like to provide as much as we possibly can, but we also understand that there are associations like the National Rural Health Clinic Association that have information out there that you might want to take advantage of. So we try and link to many of our partners as we can, and we also try to make sure that their ICD-10 information is front and center, because we don't want people to have to dig for information. So there's a lot of information out there, and we do have some other things that we're going to be doing. In fact, I think starting tomorrow, we're going to be running a series of ads in national trade and professional publications, as well as on some banner, not banner ads, but on some URLs that are healthcare related. And these are going to be basically provider-oriented, saying, you know, the change is coming, are you aware of it, here is where you need to go for more information, and again, driving everybody to that ICD-10 website. The other place that these are going to appear are in a lot of regional and state medical association journals and publications, because we're trying, again, to dig down to a more rural, frontier area level. Having come from the Kansas City Regional Office of CMS, I absolutely understand the need to not only address the Johns Hopkins systems of the world, but also the two provider facility out in Beloit, Kansas. You know, they need information too, and a lot of times they're challenged by budget, by location, by access to technology and the internet. So we can't forget that even though we're talking about high-tech changes, we also have to make sure that we're reaching out appropriately at all levels so that people get information when they need it. So those are some of the things that we're working on. That's just, again, a very high-level overview of what we're looking at. I would welcome any questions that you have. I'll try to answer them. If I don't have answers, I will try and get you answers. I'm lucky enough to have a terrific staff and great resources here. And, again, Bill, thank you so much for the opportunity, and we can open up the mic.
Great. Thanks, Denise. I appreciate it. Operator, do you want to give the instructions for asking a question? And then I have a couple I'll ask while we're waiting for folks to line up in the queue.
Thank you very much. And the question and answer session will be conducted electronically. To ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. A voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line is open to ask a question. We also ask that you please state your name and the state you are calling from before posing your question. Once again, press star 1 to ask a question, and we will pause for a moment to assemble the queue.
And while we're waiting, Denise, you made reference to the fact that Medicare will be ready to test on January 1, and we've heard a lot of encouraging reports about that, but not so much with regard to Medicaid. There's a lot of concern about Medicaid programs not being as up to speed as Medicare. What is your sense on where the Medicaid programs are with regard to ICD-10 and 5010?
Bill, thank you for bringing that up, because that's obviously of critical importance. As I mentioned before, we do have responsibility for making sure that our Medicaid state programs are also in compliance with both of these standards. And we recognized early on that we were going to have to be proactive and go out there and ask some tough questions. And we did just that. I guess it was back in the spring of this year. We did an environmental scan, as we call it, of all of the state Medicaid agencies. It was 188 questions, and I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It doesn't look good for the simple reason that we all know states are under the gun when it comes to budget and resources and, you know, all sorts of challenges out there for them. So we're being very proactive. We are working very closely with our Medicaid side of the house. I know that they had a NMIS meeting out in Portland, I guess it was last month, and it's a topic of discussion as well. What we're doing is, I believe starting next week, the Medicaid SMEs, subject matter experts, are going to be conducting calls with each one of the state Medicaid agencies, asking them for what are their challenges, what are their barriers to compliance, where do they think they're going to be at a certain point. And then after that, they're going to do an analysis and go out to each one of the states, do a site visit, and see what resources we can offer them to help them get compliant. You know, it might be, you know, and again, I'm not speculating here, but if, for example, if we have some states that still aren't compliant with 4010, what can we do to get them compliant? Do they need to get the services of a clearinghouse? Do we need to group them together in like groups and make sure that they get resources targeted towards them? This has gotten attention at the highest levels of the agency, and the Medicaid side of the house is very much aware of this, and they have a plan in place to at least get a certain level of compliance among the states, because, again, they realize that if Medicaid isn't ready, then there's going to be a problem. So definitely getting time, attention, and resources from CMS.
Now, the Office of eHealth Standards is somewhat unique. I think often folks see that you're housed within CMS and say, oh, okay, well, you know, they're responsible for Medicare and perhaps Medicaid, but who do I go to when I have an issue with regard to a commercial insurer or private insurer? The Office of eHealth Standards has a jurisdictional responsibility here that extends beyond the government programs. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. We wear two sides of a hat here. We are responsible for implementation of ICD-10 and version 5010, you know, with our own Medicare and Medicaid programs, but we also are responsible for making sure the rest of the industry is ready as well. So we have two tracks. We have an internal communications track to our Medicare fee-for-service community and our plans, and then we also have a track, again, going out to external industry groups like this one. From an enforcement perspective, we have, and I wear this hat in particular, I am in charge of HIPAA enforcement. And when I say HIPAA enforcement, you know, we talk about there are a number of different facets to HIPAA. One is privacy and security, and the other one is the transaction and code sets. When I say we, OESS used to have responsibility for security, and that was transitioned last year to the Office for Civil Rights. So the Office for Civil Rights handles complaints on privacy and security. We handle complaints about HIPAA transactions and code set violations. So if we have a provider who is trying to transmit, who's trying to conduct a transaction using a standard with a plan, and for some reason the plan is not responding appropriately or is not using the standard, we have an intake, a complaint intake procedure. It involves what we call the asset system. They can actually go online, give us their information, and then we will have a subject matter expert, number one, determine that it's a valid complaint, and number two, if it is, then we will pursue getting it straightened out. A lot of times we work very proactively with the filed against entity as well as the complainant to bring them together, not with a mind towards punitive damages, so to speak, or trying to be heavy-handed, but just to say, you know, the bottom line is let's get compliant on this. So we really work to help them achieve compliance. So we put them on what they call a CAP. Basically, it's a long-term, and I say long-term, like a six-month plan to get them compliant with what they're supposed to be doing. Now, obviously, if that doesn't work for some reason or we find there's no good faith effort on the part of a filed against entity to get compliant, then we do have under the law some damages, so to speak, that we can some penalties that we can apply to them, and I believe it's a maximum of $25,000 a year. Now, according to the Affordable Care Act, some of those charges will go up in the future years for being non-compliant, but for right now, that's the maximum that we can impose. And most often, we are very successful at being able to so-called arbitrate between the two parties. We've had a number of instances where even some of the complaints and some of the situations baffled us, but we do our very best to try and get them.
Hello? Hello?
Okay. And Ms. Benny, if you can hear us, we're unable to hear you. Please check the mute function.
Hello?
Hello?
I'm sorry, we just lost power here for a second.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Anyhow, as I was saying, we try very hard to work with the covered entities and come to resolution. We're trying to streamline our processes, trying to cut down the amount of time that we're having between a response and submission of a plan and resolution, that sort of thing. So we're stepping in line with, I think, the overall goal of the administration to get it done quickly, get it done right, and get it done expeditiously.
Great. Operator, why don't we go ahead and start taking some calls, if we have some calls in the queue?
Certainly. Caller, please go ahead. Please announce your name and the state.
Go ahead, caller.
And that questioner, if you can hear us, we're unable to hear you. Please check your mute function. Hearing nothing, we will go to our next question. Please announce your name and state before posing your question.
Hi, my name is Sherry. I'm calling from North Dakota. One of the questions that I had was regarding the non-HIPAA-covered entities. You were talking, like, about workforce safety.
Mm-hmm.
That mean that they are not going to be upgrading to the 5010 or ICD-10 and that we have to, I don't know, that just confuses me. Are they, they're just not HIPAA covered? That just kind of, I guess, surprised me. And how does that affect us?
Okay. That's a very good question. And no, they are technically, they were excluded from the original HIPAA legislation. So life insurers and workers' compensation programs do not have to use the HIPAA standards. We've heard varying reports about what their plans are. We've heard some information that says we're just going to continue to use 9 codes and you're just going to have to deal with it on you know, your end. You're going to have to crosswalk it. Or we've heard others say, you know, maybe it's time to make a change to 10 since the rest of the industry is doing this. And we're still trying to assess that out in the field, whether which circumstance is correct and if it's a hybrid of one or whatever. So we hope to have more information on that in the next few months as we go forward. You know, it becomes really problematic, for example, you know, any provider dealing with a big workers' compensation caseload or emergency rooms. You know, obviously some of these things are covered through automobile insurers. So there are some problematic aspects to being not covered under HIPAA versus covered. But we hope to push some more information out there as we hear it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, caller. Next up.
And ladies and gentlemen, as a reminder, if you wish to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. We'll take our next question.
Go ahead, caller.
And caller, if you can hear us, we are unable to hear you. Please announce your name and state from which you are calling.
Having some technical difficulties today. Why don't we go to the next one?
Okay. Next caller, please go ahead.
I have a question regarding the ICD-10 training.
Can you give us your name and where you're calling from?
I'm sorry. Mary Wolf from Garden County Health Services in Nebraska.
Great. Go ahead, Mary.
I've called several of our colleges in the area, and they do not have any ICD-10 courses available, nor do they know when they are going to implement any.
Interesting. Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Mary.
I guess I was just wondering if a HEMA or super trainers were going to be the only way for us to get educated for that.
It's interesting that you mentioned that because I know, obviously, a HEMA and AAPC is doing extensive training on ICD-10. I was surprised that one of my colleagues had forwarded me information today about a company that's offering ICD-9, the updated version for 2011, but absolutely no mention of ICD-10. And that may be because of two things. Number one, it may just be too soon. As I mentioned before, the recommendation on this has been to wait until around 6 months out. I would imagine that as you get closer to the end of next year, you're going to see a lot more training opportunities come up. I would say if for some reason you want to get training now, I would probably contact AHIMA or AAPC and see what they have available. And again, that's not any endorsement of those two particular organizations. I just happen to know that they do offer training programs.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
And we will take our next questioner. Caller, please go ahead.
Go ahead, caller.
This is Shelley from Wisconsin.
Hey, Shelley.
Hi.
Hi. We had a question. With the day that the ICD-9 or ICD-10 is implemented and we can use, is there going to be a carryover for ICD-9?
Yeah. This is something that we actually have a work group looking at. What happens, for example, if you are asking, you call up on September the 28th asking for a pre-authorization for a surgery that's taking place after the 1st of October of 2013. And from what we're gathering right now, that's going to be dealt with on a plan-by-plan basis. I don't know that there's been any industry-wide consensus as to how that's going to be handled. You know, I would imagine, you know, there are one of two things. They can do a kind of a limbo period where they might hold off on doing any kind of transactions or claim adjudication for a couple of days to kind of give it a breather and then start processing what they've got afterwards that's submitted you know, with 10 codes, or they may crosswalk it, or they may just reject it and you have to refile under 10. So it depends on what the plan is deciding to do. And as I said, we haven't heard any industry-wide consensus on this yet, but we're working really closely with AHIP, America's Health Insurance Plans, and trying to see what their take on this might be. So I'd say probably at this point, stay tuned.
Denise, a little bit along those lines, and also for the previous caller, in terms of the non-covered entities, can you talk a little bit about the whole issue of crosswalks and GEMS and what CMS is doing in that area?
Sure. A couple of things. We've developed what we call a crosswalk, and that basically is taking an ICD-9 code and translating it to an ICD-10 code, or vice versa, taking a 10 code and translating or mapping it back to a 9 code. The difficulty in that is it's not always a one-to-one correlation. You might have one ICD-9 code that translates into 50 different ICD-10 codes. So there have to be some decisions made as to which codes you're going to submit and which codes are going to be used the most frequently. And the and I know that there is some discussion out there that there may be some plans that are developing proprietary crosswalks. Well, if you go back to the Affordable Care Act that was passed earlier this year, it has in there a provision, and it says that the crosswalk that is posted to the CMS website shall be, and I put this in quotes, treated as a part of the code set. So what that basically says is if you're a covered entity under HIPAA and you have to transition from ICD-9 to ICD-10 and you're using a crosswalk as a tool to help you make that transition, you should use the crosswalk that's posted to the CMS website. What they did in the act also was to mandate a public meeting be held by January of 2011 that provided a public forum for people to give their comments on the crosswalk. Well, we actually had that meeting back here on, I believe it was September the 15th. It just so happened that the Coordination and Maintenance Committee, which is the entity that was named in the law as having jurisdiction over this, they just so happened to be having their fall meeting, and they devoted a half a day to this subject. So we had people get up there and testify. They felt that there were some codes that were missing, some codes that, typographical types of issues. So the committee is taking all of this into consideration, and in fact, if you have questions about the codes or want to make any recommendations about changes to the codes, you can submit them, I think, as of November the 12th is the cutoff. The committee will take a look at all the recommendations, make the appropriate changes, and then post that code set to the CMS website. It's free of charge. You can download it, and so that would be the one that you would use. The crosswalks, or they call them GEMS, general equivalency mappings. You kind of hear those terms used interchangeably. They're not designed to be a permanent fix. In other words, don't use these. You should be working towards changing your systems over, changing over your manuals, et cetera, et cetera. You're doing a full-blown transition as opposed to just using a crosswalk for temporarily dealing with 9 codes that come in, because obviously on a system-wide basis, you wouldn't be able to sustain any kind of volume if it hits you. So they're a tool to use. They're not a total cure, but they're out there for everybody to use.
Okay. Operator, we'll take another call.
At this time, we have no further questions in the queue.
Okay. Well, if people wanted to get the GEMS or learn more about it, or also back to the earlier question with regard to if they find that they're having a problem with a health plan, being non-responsive, and they want to think about a complaint, where do we direct folks to go on either of those, on the GEMS or a complaint issue regarding something on the HIPAA compliance?
Okay. On the GEMS, they can go to the ICD-10 website, which is www.icd10.gov, and hold on, I'm actually pulling up the website right now. And there are, again, you can go to the side of that, and they'll have a guide for you to actually pull down the code sets and the GEMS. Let's see here, www.cms.gov/ICD-10. and you see, and on the side of it, it has ICD-10 coordination and maintenance committee meetings. It has the GEMS. It has the 2010 ICD-10 PCS and GEMS, 2011 ICD-10 CM and GEMS. You can actually download it right from the ICD-10 website.
Okay, great.
So that's your first line of defense, so to speak.
Okay. And what if they are encountering a problem with a plan and feel that the plan is not compliant or processing a compliantly submitted claim? Where can they go or what should they do there?
Okay, you should be able to go to the HHS.gov, actually you can go to the CMS.gov website. And I'm just trying to get the exact URL.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you want to send it...
I can send it to you, and then you can disseminate it.
You can disseminate it out to the listserv so that folks will have that.
You know, I have to admit, I'm so used to just going into my internal system that sometimes I forget that there's a public out there that has to access it as well. So it's kind of like, you know, not remembering your own phone number because
exactly.
You can dial it.
Yep, I have the same problem. if there are no other questions from the line, then I think we're just up on about an hour. So we can go ahead and operator, we have no more questions?
That's it. We do have a few more questions that have just queued up.
Okay. Denise, do you have a couple more minutes?
Yes, I'm supposed to go to another meeting, but I'd like to obviously answer as many questions as I can.
We'll try and get in one or two more here. We'll see how long they are. Go ahead, operator.
Okay, caller, please go ahead.
Yes, this is Gail in Missouri. We have a question regarding revenue codes. With the new ICD-10, will there be rev codes? Will they be updated? What will happen?
I wish I could answer that question for you, Gail, but I don't know about that. But let me pose that to my coding people, and if there's a way that I can get your email address, I can get a response to you.
Okay.
We're not anticipating a need to change revenue codes, if you want to – Denise, you want to check that out and then get it to us?
How would I get it to Gail?
Gail, if you want to, you can either get it. Gail, are you on the listserv?
Yes.
Okay. Well, if you want to get that to us, we'll just post it up on the listserv. That way, Gail doesn't have to give her email address to everybody who's on the phone line.
Okay, that's great.
Thank you.
Okay. Take another question.
Okay, caller, please go ahead.
Yes, this is Judy from North Carolina. If you purchase the ICD-10 mapping book, would that be a good tool to help you?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part of your question.
If you purchase the ICD-10 mapping book, would that be a good tool to help you?
Yes, absolutely. It will give you some basics. A tool that you would use if you're manually coding or, you know, just doing very kind of, I don't say low-level coding, but, obviously if you're doing something much larger, then you would need to pretty much do a systems changeover and become more, do a more prolific changeover.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Anyone else, operator?
Yes, Paul, please go ahead.
Go ahead, caller.
I want to sign up for the ICD-10 listserv. Which website do you go to sign up for that? Is it on page 17 or 19?
On your slides, it's going to be slide number slide number 19. If you go to the website, which again is www.cms.gov/ICD-10, and on your left-hand side, of course, now it's not pulling up, it's going to say listserv sign up. I think the rain has waterlogged our system here. There it goes. If you go over on your left-hand side, the first one says latest news, and you scroll down at the bottom, and it will say latest page news watch or latest news page, and then you can sign up there. So all of the links, because of the way our system is set up, we can't embed links into text. But if you go to the bottom of the pages, that's where all of your links are to get to where you need to go.
Okay, thank you.
Caller, where are you calling from?
Wisconsin.
Okay, great. Thank you. Is there anyone else? Otherwise, we can end it here.
We do have one more questioner.
Okay, if that's it, then we'll take this one last question.
Okay, great.
Caller, please go ahead.
I have the same previous question with the listserv. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Well, again, I want to thank Denise Benning from CMS, Office of eHealth Standards, for taking some time today to talk with you. I also want to thank all of our participants and the questions that were raised. As I mentioned earlier, a call transcript from today's presentation, along with the recording, will be made available on the Office of Rural Health Policy's website. We'll send out an announcement when that is available. I want to encourage you to get others to sign up and use this listserv. Use this information. It's out there for you to help educate you. We know it's difficult sometimes to get to meetings, and we try to do this as a means of helping to educate people. The next Rural Health Clinic Technical Assistance call will most likely occur in November, although we may have something sooner than that, depending upon some possible events going on here in Washington and Baltimore. But a notice of that will be sent out via email to those who are registered for the conference call series. Again, I want to thank everyone. I especially want to thank the Federal Office of Rural Health Policy for their support for this project and this initiative, and thank everyone for participating today.
And that does conclude today's conference. We thank you for your participation.